This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. Signature support is from First Financial Tax and Accounting Services. And your number is 877-217-5757. Emails to talk at talklouisiana.org. Normally on Thursdays, we visit with Mark Ballard of The Advocate, but this week he will be on hand tomorrow. So you won't want to miss him tomorrow catching us up on what's going on in the political world, in the Beltway and beyond. But we start the show today with Alex Marr, who's a compelling writer who has a remarkable story that didn't gain as much attention as it probably should have because it has all the elements of a riveting account of mankind. Ruth Pelkey was a 78-year-old American from Gary, Indiana, who was murdered by Paula Cooper, age 15, in 1985. Cooper stabbed Pelkey 33 times with a butcher knife before stealing $10 in her car, and Paula Cooper was sentenced to death. The book is called 70 Times 7. And good morning to you, Alex Marr.
Good morning, Jim.
Well, how in the world did you get on the trail of this story?
You know, I was doing some research into the criminal justice system, particularly violent crimes committed by women, because they're relatively quite rare. And I just stumbled across this particular case, and it stopped me in my tracks. And it's for a couple of reasons. One was the fact of Paula Cooper's age, that she was just 15 when she committed this truly heinous crime, and that she was sentenced to death for it at such a young age. But the other piece of it was that a few months after her death sentence, the victim's grandson, Bill Pelkey, decided to publicly forgive Paula for killing his grandmother. And this was against the wishes of his family, his friends, the members of his congregation, his coworkers. I mean, truly, he came out alone at that moment. But he believed that his grandmother would never have wanted a child to be executed in her name, and that that would not constitute justice. And that set some incredible events into motion that I get at in the book.
Alex Marr is a veteran writer. Her first book was Witches of America, which was a New York Times notable book. Her work has been chosen for the Best American Magazine Writing, and now she has found an amazing story and a tragic story, 70 times 7. Paula Cooper was 15 when she committed this crime, and what kind of a life did she have after that, after going to jail?
Well, you know, I will also just mention for your listeners that before the crime, you know, she was a young girl who was living in an abusive home. She had been placed in emergency shelters, foster care, multiple times. She and her sister Rhonda, with whom she was so close, they ran away from home multiple times together trying to get help. And they were always returned home. And shortly before the crime, that was the situation. And you know, I think that she snapped on that afternoon. Over time, so her sentence was commuted because of the work of some incredible appellate attorneys, attention that was brought by in the international press. Even Pope John Paul II ended up making a statement asking that Paula Cooper's death sentence be commuted. So you have all of that, plus her victim's grandson making statements that, you know, we should have mercy in this case. We should not execute this girl. Her sentence is commuted. She ends up serving 27 years in prison in Indiana, an appropriately serious sentence. And during that time, she actually evolves as a person. She gets her GED. She gets a college degree. She's corresponding with pen pals all around the world. I read a huge amount of correspondence between her and Bill, between her and people abroad who just wanted to know about her life. And I saw this picture of someone who was really growing, changing, finding her own voice while in prison. And when she got out, she actually ended up being offered a job in, of all places, the Federal Public Defender's Office in Indianapolis. So her job every day was to work the phones, talking to people in the Department of Correction in Indiana, and, you know, advocating for some of the clients represented by the attorneys in the office. She wasn't afraid to work within the system when she got out. But I think what you're referring to is the fact that, you know, ultimately after less than 2 years outside, she did end up taking her own life. I believe, and in some of the materials she left behind, you know, she suggested this. I believe that what happened is she matured as a person, and the remorse that she felt for what she had done as a young person really hit hard. And that combined with the trauma of such a long incarceration, you know, that it was just not something she was equipped for. But the book does not end there. For me, this book is a bigger story of many individuals who were galvanized and inspired by Paula's case to try to make change. Jeff Bill, who continued to advocate for mercy in the justice system, he ended up actually creating a network of other individuals around the country who were also murder victims' family members who chose not to support the death penalty in their cases. And they still do work today trying to share their stories and to show that, you know what, the families of the victims are not always in line with what the prosecutor wants. And then you have people who, you know, a network of attorneys who fought for Paula and continue to fight and help to bring about an end to the death sentence for juveniles in this country, which did not come to an end until as recently as 2005.
All right, hold your fire. You're covering a lot of ground here, and it is a compelling story. But Paula Cooper did die of her own hand.
Yes.
After being released a couple of years, and she served 27 years. Her lawyers described her as a victim of sexual abuse who had attended 10 different schools by the time of the murder. She did have a prior record as a runaway, and for burglary, there was little question of her guilt. She was considered the ringleader of a group aged 14 to 16, all girls who were given sentences of 25 to 60 years for their roles in a terribly heinous crime. And at 15, it would seem that is a bit much for the death penalty. But as we know, the death penalty has been unevenly and inexactly implemented in this country. The governor of Louisiana last week, finally, after many years in which we speculated as such, he says he's against the death penalty. So I suspect that if he were presented with a case in which he had to make a call, he would stop it, and he would be the first governor of Louisiana to do that, by the way. But 15 years old, she had a terrible life. Some would say that doesn't excuse what she did to this elderly woman, who obviously was defenseless and didn't deserve to die this way. How do you respond to those who have that opinion?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I agree with that 100%. And Bill Pelkey would have said the same. You know, that the idea here is, you know, he had said to me a number of times, to forgive is not to forget. It is not to say, well, now you're off the hook. But, you know, in his case, it was let's try to come up with a punishment that doesn't mean taking another life, right? Because you're creating another victim. And on top of that, this is an individual who has family members as well. And they will then be traumatized. And they took no part in that crime. You know, I think one thing that this story raised for me that I found very moving is the sense that there's a family on either side of any case, of any crime. And our system is built in such a way that it just doesn't make sense most of the time for those two families to have any kind of dialogue. They may have humanity in common. They may see some aspects of the situation eye to eye. They never have that opportunity to find that out because the prosecutor has an agenda, a specific sentence they're going for, and that would complicate that. So in this case, you know, Bill reaching across the aisle, to me, that is a really profound and profound gesture that raises a lot of questions. You know, we talk a lot right now about divisions in this country. We're all feeling it. And I wonder if there's something in this story that we can learn from and maybe be inspired by on that level.
The book is 70 Times 7 from Alex Marr, who logged 5 intensive years researching and writing the book. And it does have a racial element that you reflect on. How significant was that?
I think it is an ingredient in many stories about our criminal justice system, because race is a complex issue in this country. And there's a racial bias, we know now, built into capital punishment. You're far more likely to get the death sentence if the victim was white than if the victim was a person of color. So there is that. There is also a really serious history of segregation.
Well, we do have to roll. Robin Dow says it's time, and I know you've got another appointment, Alex Marr, but the book is 70 Times 7, a compelling story about the murder of Ruth Pelkey and the life of Paula Cooper. Thank you so much. Back after this 90-second pause. This is Jim Engster. Thanks for being with us for Talk Louisiana. Robin Dow's our producer, and in a few moments we'll hear from another outstanding writer, Davis Miller, who has logged much of his career writing about the champ, Muhammad Ali. By the way, the last time Ali won a fight was September 15th, 1978, Louisiana Superdome. He beat Leon Spinks to win the title for a third time. He was 36 years old. And now, as we do the math, in September, it will be 45 years since that fight in the Dome, in which he still looked in tip-top shape, and that's where he should have quit. Ultimately, he did come back and fight twice more against Larry Holmes and Trevor Burbick, and it didn't work out so well. But he still is regarded by most as the greatest heavyweight of all time, and by many as the greatest fighter of all time. And as we know, he was a riveting personality who soared above all others in the sporting world and perhaps in the real world. And when he was in his prime, he was the most famous man on the planet. We'll talk about Ali, and there will be a salute to him in a most unusual way from Opera Louisiana this weekend. So Davis Miller has all the ingredients about what's going to happen, saluting the champ and doing so with an opera. But right now we're joined for a few minutes by Undersecretary Brian McClinton of the Department of Wildlife and Fisheries, and he is here to tell us about the Louisiana Outdoors Forever program, total of $10 million in the program that conservation organizations, NGOs, public agencies, others can apply for it. Good morning to you, Brian.
Good morning, sir. Thank you for having me.
Well, what do you have to do to apply?
Well, you go to our website. From our website, there's a link right in the middle of the page, and it says Louisiana Outdoor Forever, and it will take you to a page that has a manual. It has help for, you know, a video to show you how to apply, but it's wlf.louisiana.gov, Louisiana Wildlife and Fisheries webpage. Will take you to the link right in the middle of the page, Louisiana Outdoor Forever, and you basically have to write, this is a program that is set up to help Louisiana be more competitive for other grant programs that exist out there. This is something that was started by a group of NGOs several years ago, seeing what other states had done, like the Nature Conservancy, Wildlife Federation, Conservation Fund, Audubon, Ducks Unlimited, got together and they started looking at other states that had similar programs and how they were able to secure more federal dollars for their state, because municipalities or conservation districts, water districts, levee districts, those types of entities, or parish governments, state agencies could apply for this, and then this will be that matching source of revenue. So if you have a small city and you don't have a lot of cash, you can apply for this to sort of help you meet those matching requirements and bring those dollars to your area.
The money must be used for land conservation, improving fish and wildlife habitats, projects to improve water quality, development of recreational properties related to public use. So it's a wide opportunity, but still you have to be doing something to help mankind and help the environment and in these particular areas. And this was done through a legislative measure through, I believe it was Representative Zerang, wasn't it?
Yes, sir. Representative Zerang, it was House Bill 406, set up the $10 million, House Bill 762 last year, established the program. And so by two bills that he sponsored, we were able to have this opportunity. And so right now it's just $10 million. And so other states that have done this is Washington, Oregon, Colorado, Minnesota, Georgia. But Mississippi and Louisiana both stood our programs up last year. We both have very similar $10 million. And so what we're hoping is to see a lot of projects, a lot of applications come in, and you know, be able to go back to the legislature and say, see, there is a real need for this, and these are examples of the types of things we could do if we had recurring, you know, year, funding year over year.
Well, so, it's available through the pre-application window May 19th, so we've got a little time, and instructional video and a full program manual can be accessed by going to wlf.louisiana.gov. So, Brian McClinton, I would suspect with $10 million available, you'll get lots of action, and hopefully people who are listening to this show can think about what they would do, and they can certainly benefit from it. But this is something that I would think makes people feel good because they're doing something to help mankind.
Yes, sir. And that's where hope is, that people listen to this show, they know, you know, somebody who works for one of these organizations or municipalities, parish government, and they say, hey, go to this website, look at this, see this application, see what's available. And a lot of those entities have been usually applying for grants and are familiar with some of the programs. They, you know, they have that wish list that's out there. Well, this is something that can make those, you know, wishes come true. So, thank you for the time. I really appreciate it.
Well, thank you. Undersecretary Brian McClinton from the Department of Wildlife and Fisheries. Good talking with you, Brian. Thank you, sir.
Yes, sir.
We're joined in studio now by Davis Miller, who drove to be on this show 900 miles from Asheville, North Carolina. And he had an unusual relationship with the champ, and Muhammad Ali, to have been the most famous person on the planet, was one of the most accessible people. I wish I had been in his orbit. I never was, never met the man, but I regard him as one of the most influential people in my life. And back in the day when I was a kid in Little Rock, you could almost tell anybody's point of view on any number of world events, social aspects, if you just said the word Muhammad Ali and how they reacted. The same is true today, by the way, of Donald Trump. They were polarizing figures. But in Ali's case, he has rested well with historians. He is a person who was on the right side of history in many ways. He resisted the draft, which some protested, but he didn't do what others did, resist the draft, make up reasons not to go to Vietnam, and then run for president and win the office. And that's what's happened more than once in the U.S. over the last several years. But Davis Miller, who is 70 years old, which means he was a bit younger than the champ, who would have been 80. He is in Baton Rouge for, as I stated, an unusual coupling, opera and Ali, at the Manship Theater. Tell us a little bit about this spectacular combination we're going to have right here in our midst.
Well, thank you, Jim. The opera was originally commissioned by the Washington National Opera back in 2013. And It's had a really great run. It premiered at the Kennedy Center to a sold-out performances. This will be the fourth performance, and it just had its West Coast premiere last week at Opera Las Vegas. And I'm excited about this particular couple of performances. One reason is that the composer, DJ Spar, who became a great friend while we were working together on the opera, lives in Baton Rouge. And I'm actually trying to convince him to do another opera about Huey Long. But that's another story altogether. But Ali and I were great pals for 30 years. It's not overstatement to say he saved my life. I first met him what will be 35 years ago. On a Friday, the anniversary tomorrow night will be the premiere performance with Opera Louisiane. And wrote a story about the experience. It was a out-of-body experience for me and a transformative one. It made me a writer. and I was managing video stores in Louisville, Kentucky. Lost my job on that very day, found out that the stores were all going to be closed, was driving home terribly depressed, and coincidentally drove past a house I knew to be Ollie's mother's house. And there was this block-long white Winnebago parked in front with license plates that read, "The Greatest." And having some small clue that that was my childhood idol, I worked up my courage, walked up to, got ready to knock on the door of the Winnebago, and he opened the door. He was already deeply Parkinsonian, spoke very little at that point, but he waved me in with two fingers of his right hand, did magic tricks. He was a good amateur magician. We got out in his mom's front yard and playboxed for about 5 minutes with cars stopping all around, kids on bicycles yelling, "Hey, champ, hey, champ." And then he leaned over after we moved around for a minute.
Hold that thought. We will be back with Davis Miller after this. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. Robin Dow producing. 877-217-5757. And in studio is Davis Miller, who drove 900 miles from Asheville, North Carolina, to be with us. And he'll be involved in the opera presentation at the Manship Theater this weekend, Friday and Saturday. Approaching Ali. Davis is the author of The Tao of Muhammad Ali. And he told us as we were going to the break about his meeting him, meeting the champ, in 1989, March 31st, Louisville, Kentucky. And it just so happened that he drives by Muhammad Ali's mom's house, and there's the champ, who is in his Winnebago, and brings him in. And this sparked Davis's first published story, My Dinner with Ali, that got all kinds of attention. It was nominated by Sport Magazine for the National Magazine Award, and was the inspiration for the creation of the Best American Sports Writing Yearly Anthology. And so I didn't want to finish or to stop you from finishing your story, but so he motions you in and you're with the champ. By then, this is 1989, he would have been 47, you would have been 37. He's past his prime. He's affected immensely and tragically by all the blows he took in the ring. And you're 37, and you've just lost your job. What happened?
It changed my life. He invited me after we boxed for a few minutes, or play boxed for a few minutes, with a big crowd in the yard. He leaned over and whispered in my ear, "Come on in the house." And he invited me into his mom's for dinner with his mom and himself. And it was an out-of-body experience. It was transformative in my life. And here I was, just lost my job that day, had been managing video stores, had always wanted to be a writer. We became buds on that night. And I thought I saw some things in Ali that no one had ever written about. He'd be in, at that time, he was regarded as basically in a nearly vegetative state, as effectively punch drunk. And that's not the guy I was hanging out with. I found that he'd been made wise in many respects by his Parkinsonism, and that in some ways he was as much Ali as he ever had been. And I was naive enough to pick up the phone and call an editor at Esquire magazine. I picked the guy's name out of a masthead. His name was David Hershey, and I thought about chocolate bars. And rang up David, and he happened to answer his phone. I pitched the idea over the phone and said, "You know, I'm becoming friends with Muhammad Ali. I had this remarkable evening with him, and I want to write about it." And I was unpublished as a writer, and now I know it doesn't happen this way, but after a 10 or 15-minute conversation, he gave me the assignment. It was never published in Esquire. Was instead published in Ali's home newspaper, the Louisville Courier-Journal, and then in Sport. And I've been a writer ever since. Mm-hmm. Tao of Muhammad Ali was a number one bestseller. My most recent book, Approaching Ali, I lifted the title from the opera. And the opera is about that very first meeting with Ali on that night, March 31st, which again is when coincidentally when we have the Opera Louisiane premiere. And it was a night that changed my life, and I think in some respects may have even changed his.
Well, he was open to people beyond his inner circle. And that's apparent by becoming friends with this gentleman, Davis Miller, who obviously has benefited from his relationship with Muhammad Ali. And for those of us of a certain generation, you know, we grew up watching Ali on ABC. They used to run his fights generally after the fact, but sometimes live. I remember him losing to Kenny Norton in 1973 when his jaw was broken in the first round and he went the distance and lost a split decision, one of his five defeats. And nobody ever knocked out Muhammad Ali, not even Larry Holmes, who beat him brutally in Las Vegas in 1980. Nobody knocked out Muhammad Ali. And that may be one of the reasons why he was affected by all the blows he took, is that he would not go down. And if he did go down, as he did with Joe Frazier in March of 1971, he got right back up. But here's Howard Cosell, who forevermore is entwined in history with Muhammad Ali, who David Kindred, the great sports writer, wrote Sound and Fury, and the two of them had a symbiotic relationship, if there ever was one. And Robin Dowes pulled up a sampling of the interchange between the greatest fighter and perhaps the greatest sportscaster of all time.
Good to see you, champ.
Howard Cosell, the world's greatest newscaster. How are you feeling?
You're very kind, champ, but let's get to cases.
I'm afraid that it might hurt the gate if I let them know what's going to happen, so I'll just hold a surprise for them.
But
I know what's going to happen.
What's going to happen?
I can't just told you. Let me tell him.
No, you can't tell him. You got to wait.
Let me tell him.
You can't tell him.
The people are waiting for the prediction.
You can't tell him.
I'll tell you what's going to happen, see?
No, don't tell him.
All right, come on.
I can't tell you.
You're going to knock him out. What round?
I'm not going. You want me to tell him? I can't tell you. I can't tell you because it'll hurt
you. You don't see any way that Liston can neutralize your footwork.
If he dreamed he did, he'd apologize.
On the other side of the coin, Liston seems this time to be taking you a lot more seriously than the last
time. Well, I'm taking him a lot more seriously.
Why? If you're as good as you say and as confident as you say.
I'm as confident as I say, and I'm better than I say I am.
I hope it's not an act. I hope you mean it.
If it's an act, just look at my record and see if there have the other fights been acts. Have they been acts?
Not so far.
Well, what makes you think I'm acting?
That was Muhammad Ali before the second fight with Charles Sonny Liston. They called him the Black Bear, and he was an 8-1 favorite in 1964. He had knocked out Floyd Patterson twice in the first round, seemingly invincible. And Ali beat him in Miami, Florida in February of 1964 when Ali was 22. And a year later, Ali had become Muhammad Ali. People were still calling him Cassius Clay, but he fights his first fight under the new name in Lewiston, Maine, of all places. And in the first round, he knocked out Charles Sonny Liston. Some say it was a phantom punch, but when you look at those photos of Ali, he was incredibly fit. And here's a guy who didn't lift weights either, but he looked the part. He looked like a guy who could knock out a guy with one punch, Davis Miller.
He was, in many respects, Michelangelo's David in appearance. And that's the single most famous sports photograph of all time, I think, is the one with him towering over Sonny Liston with his arms raised above his head. I personally, of course, I'm prejudiced in this regard, but I think Ali is the greatest athlete of all times. Sports Illustrated named him that. So did the BBC. And also an equally remarkable human being. As you've mentioned, ultimately accessible, maybe the world's most accessible human being. And I think by the time he died, I think that people had come to recognize that he was, in many respects, everybody's nearly infirm granddaddy because of his Parkinsonism. And that was a new mythology. I don't think that had ever existed before Ali. I think as long as there are human beings, the name Muhammad Ali will be known.
I don't know of any person on earth who has ever given so many gifts. He He was fabulously handsome. He was remarkably talented as a fighter, and he was quick with his lips as he was with his fists. He had a mind that was razor sharp, and he was open to all kinds of people and a really funny, funny guy and tough as nails. What a man.
He stayed that way too, which people don't recognize. And I think that's one of the unique things about my story is that people regard him as having become less than he was, where in reality, the guy I was hanging out with in the 1980s and 1990s was extraordinary. Whenever he did bother to say something, it was with enormous insight, and he remained incredibly funny.
Muhammad Ali died June 3rd, 2016. He was 74 years old, and he certainly exceeded what many thought would be a short life after his life in the ring, which spanned from the Olympics of 1960 all the way to 1981 when he fought Trevor Burbick. And other than the 3.5 years in which he was in exile, he was an active fighter, one after the other. He loved to fight. He loved the payday. He loved the attention. And as you know, he, like our former president, the aforementioned Donald Trump, was affected immensely by watching championship wrestling. If you watch Gorgeous George in his heyday, you get a sampling of what became Muhammad Ali.
That's spot on, Jim. Not many people recognize that.
When you had dinner with him, that was not a lavish home, I know.
No, it was very much 1950s-seeming Americana in his mom's house in Louisville. And we had a bowl of chili and a giant slice of white bread each and sat beside each other on the sofa, then drove to a video store, one of mine that I'd just been fired from, and rented a tape of VHS tape of his fights and sat side by side mm-hmm. and watched that. And he stood up and shadow boxed.
You used to kickbox with him, didn't
yeah,
you?
Yeah, I kickboxed. I was a pseudo-professional kickboxer, thought I was going to be a world champ, patterned myself after Ali, obviously didn't have that level of skill, but had the opportunity to spar with him in 1975 at his training camp in Deer Lake, Pennsylvania, and he hit me with one jab, and my legs went to turtle soup, and that was enough for me.
Muhammad Ali and the Opera Louisiane collaborating for a major production this weekend, Friday, Saturday, Manship Theater. You can go to the Opera Louisiane website.
Friday and Sunday.
Thanks for the correction. But go to the Opera Louisiane website and you can find. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for being with us for Talk Louisiana. And a reminder that Mark Ballard will be with us tomorrow for Friday Politics. He'll be back next Thursday, but tomorrow we'll hear him on our show that also airs not only on WRKF, but on WWNO. 877-217-5757, your Talk Louisiana number. Our program is brought to you by our signature sponsor, First Financial Tax and Accounting Services. I mentioned Donald Trump and his connection to professional wrestling, and he is the only U.S. president to be in the World Wrestling Federation Hall of Fame. And there's no doubt in the 8 years now since he burst on the political scene with his announcement of running for president in 2015 at Trump Tower, that he has campaigned and governed as what some might call a bad guy wrestler. And it's apparent now, even in Waco, Texas, there was Ted Nugent warming up the crowd. And Nugent says, I want my money back, as he's yelling. I didn't authorize any money to Ukraine to some homosexual weirdo. Now, as far as I know, the president of Ukraine is not homosexual, and even if he were, I'm not sure that would matter, but that's not the kind of thing you would see at a Ronald Reagan rally. I remember Paul Laxalt, the distinguished former governor of Nevada, was always with Reagan with his beautiful white mane and dignified man, and those are the kind of people who hung out with Ronald Wilson Reagan. And on March 30th, 1981, he's speaking at the Hilton on Connecticut Avenue in Washington, D.C. Reagan had just turned 70 years old, at that time the oldest president in American history. And he gives a speech, and he walks out, and then shots ring out. And John Hinckley almost kills Reagan, almost kills Jim Brady, almost kills a Secret Service agent. Reagan's lung was punctured, and Hinckley ultimately was put in a mental home, and unbelievably, last year, he was released. Now, some people believe that if you shoot a U.S. president, you should never be out on the streets again, but Hinckley not only was released, he, like many Americans, has found a way to try to profit from his notoriety. Robin, do we have that sampling of Hinckley? He's now become a singer. He has, I'm told, 25,000 followers on social media. He's not a very good singer, but he's John Hinckley. And this is the kind of thing that really makes us shake our heads in America, that a guy like this can end up being famous for shooting a president, and people can actually listen to stuff like this. Do we have it? John Hinckley?
Hello, everybody. This is my latest original song.
Now, if Chuck Berry were here, the gong would already be out. That's John Hinckley, who was 25 years old when he shot the president, and Ronald Reagan heroically fought back, started lifting weights, and actually his chest expanded, and he served two terms. I suspect he was affected by what happened to him on that day, March 30th, 1981. And if you have any thoughts, we'll take your observations. Much has happened in our world. And Robin, who goes first? We've got some people waiting in line. 877-217-5757. Let's go to our friend David in Atlanta. David, please be concise. What's on your mind regarding the 40th American president?
Jim, I'll say one thing in praise of Reagan. I'm not sure if it was an executive order or a bill passed by Congress. Lane Kirtland, the head of the AFL-CIO, who was a merchant seaman in World War II, lobbied Washington for years to declare the merchant seamen who served in combat zones full military veterans. And as a consequence, those seamen who took more casualties than the Marines in the Pacific took, they were all volunteers. Many of them were 4F. They could have stayed home and been perfectly safe, but they couldn't get into the military, so they got into the merchant seamen. Many of them died, and I think what Reagan did was something he should be honored for, because those men had to wait 40 years for their military VA veteran benefits.
Good point. And Reagan, another listener, Holly in the Garden District, points out David also was in favor of gun regulation.
That's true.
They throw him out of the Republican Party for that today, but he was out in front on that issue.
And he supported the Brady Bill.
He did. Background checks, the whole deal. And I suspect if he were alive, I can't speak for the man, obviously, but I suspect he would be against assault weapons. But thank you, David. Good to hear from you. 877-217-5757 or talk at talklouisiana.org. Tim in Thibodaux. Hi, Tim. You're on.
Thanks, Jim. This is relative to Nashville. I just heard that on NPR sources that the head of schools and her faculty person were both Louisiana linked by LSU and Baton Rouge, possibly. Can you verify this?
Yeah, there is a nice story in the Advocate today. In fact, three writers from the Associated Press note that the head of the Christian Elementary School, who was killed in the shooting on Monday in Nashville, described by friends as smart, loving, rare female leader in a male-led religious culture. Her name is Koontz, and she was one of six people who was killed, and her name's Catherine Koontz, 3 9-year-old children, as we know, and she has definitely connections to Baton Rouge, Louisiana. She was born here, and once again, Louisiana, with its 1.4% of the national population, generates far more than that as a percentage of national news, in this case, another tragedy. But Koontz was a LSU student from 1981 to 82. She transferred to Vanderbilt, where she earned a bachelor's degree. her Facebook account says she attended University High, and she gave her life in service of others in a senseless shooting, and one that almost certainly could have been avoided had this assailant not had an assault weapon. But thank you, Tim. Nice to, for you to mention Catherine Kuntz. 877-217-5757 is your number. And over the last few days, we lost two Baton Rouge police officers, too, who were in a helicopter chase of an alleged assailant. And the helicopter crashed, and it was in the middle of the night, and we really don't know the details, and I sure hope we get to it. And Miriam in Mandeville has written me a long message here, but she says, I can't quit thinking about the BRPD law enforcement pilots who crashed in a sugarcane field and weren't found or even missed by anyone but their families until 8 to 9 hours later. I wonder if they could have been alive but died of untreated blood loss, internal injuries, even exposure. And we certainly think the two men who died and lost their lives in an effort to protect us, serving the people of Baton Rouge. And now we have gotten an order from the mayor not to do these helicopter chases under the cover of darkness. They obviously are extremely dangerous, and appears the helicopter hit a tree. 877-217-5757, Stewart downtown. Stewart, good morning, sir. You're on Talk Louisiana.
Tim, I don't know who your guest may be. I just tuned in. However, a question, a comment. The comment is, as the supposed most intelligent creature, that is us Homo sapiens, then how we value and are motivated, validated by guns that are killing innocent children now is just unfathomable. And how can these officers, how can the gentleman who be charged with some sort of murder behind these cops that were crashed this helicopter. That sounds a little bit far-fetched, your guest or your comment.
All right, what are you talking about as far as the helicopter incident? Okay, all right. Yeah, I think the chase was not done without provocation, and I think Stewart's getting to the fact that the person who is responsible may be charged with some kind of crime related to the chase, but these officers were in a danger zone, and that obviously is something that they don't even have air traffic controllers at that hour of the day or night. So we'll see what happens, but let us not forget the two gentlemen who gave their lives in service to us. And I was in an event the other day in which Sid Gotro spoke, and he certainly honored the two men who died, but he did not say a word about what happened in Nashville. And I would like for some law enforcement people to talk about this, because those people killed were killed in the numbers they were because the person had an assault weapon, and cops don't like those weapons in the hands of bad people. And why doesn't the lead cop in Baton Rouge, a guy who's been in office since 2007, why doesn't he say something about it? I think Sid Gotro should get to the microphone and start talking about this, and perhaps it should be an issue in his race for re-election next year. Bill Bryan says the teacher killed in Tennessee's elementary school was raised in Leesville. So there are apparently a couple of people involved in that tragedy in Nashville who have Louisiana ties. Phil in Jefferson Terrace, we're really short on time, Phil, but if you can be really brief, go for it.
Yes, sir. We had no problem with seeing beheadings during the Iraq War. Those were things I think...
All right, we got to go, but I think I know where you were going, and we'll pick up on it tomorrow. Thanks for listening, everybody. Stay safe and stay tuned.